Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Monday, June 10th, 2019. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism from a conservative perspective. We invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads and then ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. With me, as always, Senior Editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate Editor Noah Ruthen, somewhat the worst for wear, I have to say. Not a well person, but he is here. He's a trooper. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And
present
and in Washington, in Washington, and as we continue to attempt to improve the sound quality of the show, surrounded by sound baffles, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Okay, so let us know if you hear the difference. So we are in the "Are we being gaslighted?" moment of June 2019. Donald Trump having announced that he was going to impose very large tariffs on Mexico if Mexico didn't stop migrants from hitting the border with the United States, and at the 11th hour announced that a deal had been struck with Mexico that had solved the problem, so the tariff war was over and Trump won. And then when you read the communique, it says Mexico will take steps to prevent people from coming to the border. And Trump then says there's a secret part of this that hasn't been made public. And then this morning, the Mexican foreign minister said the secret part of this is that the agreement says that if in 3 months it isn't really working, they'll have another big meeting. So that's the big secret. So my friends at the New York Post and our friend Hugh Hewitt both say, whatever, you can cavil and carp all you want. What Trump does is that he throws the fear of God into these antagonists, and he frightens them and scares them straight, and Mexico's been scared straight, and this is a big victory. And other people are saying this is ridiculous. All these steps were agreed to months ago. Kristen Nielsen, who was then the head of the Department of Homeland Security, announced them publicly, the same ones that are in the communique. And therefore, this is all just another example of Trump picking a fight and then announcing that he has quieted the fight and he has won. And these two can both be true, I guess, right?
I mean, if it wasn't a MacGuffin, though, then you would hear people who support the move talking about the move and not the president's persona or the antagonists in the fight. Literally, we're talking literally antagonists. I mean, it is a screenplay at this point.
Well, okay, so we have a real thing going on, which is that the even at the New York Times editorial page said a couple months ago that what was going on at the border is a crisis. We have an increase.
But we need to define what the crisis is. It's a real crisis now on the border, consisting of families and unaccompanied minors coming across in six figures coming across the border
every month,
which was not the case until 2019. This is not a retroactive validation of the president's crisis language over the course of the last 2 years.
No.
Numbers did not comport with the notion that there was a crisis on the border. There is
fair
one
enough.
Now. It
fair
wasn't
enough.
Before.
Fair enough. But if we try to disaggregate this, A, there's a crisis on the border. B, American liberals and mostly American pundits don't take it seriously because they fear, I believe, that to take it seriously is to give Trump that retroactive credit that you say he doesn't deserve for pointing out the issue. And then Trump puts it on Mexico, says it's Mexico's fault somehow because Mexico isn't preventing the use of its territory as a highway from the, you know, Honduran, Guatemalan, El Salvadorian populace's efforts. It's not in interdicting them.
There's also more conflation of the nature of this crisis with migration generally, where we've seen some of the president's defenders suggest that this is an attack, that the notion that there would be tariffs here is an attack on Mexico's dilution of the American labor force with these able-bodied men coming across the border looking for work. That's not what's happening here. If that was what was happening here, there wouldn't be a crisis because you can simply take able-bodied men and put them in detention. You can't do that with families.
Right. Well, so one interesting theory that I have read that I don't know how seriously to take because this is not any part of my expertise is that part of this is a manufactured crisis by the drug cartels, which are attempting to divert all American attention to this this surge at the border so that they can sneak there, so that they will be less watched when they are attempting to bring stuff across the border. That has about it a certain airplane. We know somebody in Central America is encouraging people to get up and move. It's not just that they're in trouble, that there are radio ads, there are broadcast, there are things, there are people agreeing to take them on these caravans and stuff like that. So that would indicate a kind of very interesting geopolitical crisis that whose resolution and the solving of which would only seem to require deeper American involvement in places where Trump wishes to have no American involvement whatsoever.
But it also might sort of be a problem for those on the left because, in a sense, it ties the drug problem to the migrant problem in a way that they wouldn't be comfortable with.
Right.
You know, but you know, but as regards the larger question of whether this was a sort of some sort of masterstroke or nonsense, I think it's much closer to nonsense. And I think there's another dimension of it, which is that there's another way to look at it, which is that Trump sort of goes out on a limb and then White House officials have to figure out how to get him back. And they do. And then they declare that a victory.
That's exactly what happened this week, right? Because the idea is, almost everybody was panicked about the. First of all, there are signs of an economic slowdown after the gigantic growth of the first quarter. Tariffs like these could have increased the price of the automobiles made in the United States by $5,000 or $7,000, which is an immediate, gigantic hit on the economy. This is the single most important consumer product that is produced in this country, and a lot of parts come from Mexico because of NAFTA, and so we would be hammering them. So there was panic about this, and so he was apparently, it became clear that he should step down, right? If this were really a moment at which he had to say, you have to be punished in Mexico so that you take major steps to do something about this, he would have let the tariffs, whatever face-saving agreement this is, certainly doesn't represent any kind of advance in the policy of Mexico to interdict or to somehow do something about stopping people from getting to the border. Christine?
Well, I think the other aspect of this that we should keep in mind when we look at some of the crazy Twitter rhetoric from the president over the weekend is that his administration has not yet found a suitable way to counteract the Democratic narrative about separating children from their parents at the border and about the detention of children, about the death of children while in custody. Those stories continue to really, understandably play on the emotions of voters. They're brought up a lot, at these town hall meetings, and people talk about that. That is a storyline that's very easy for voters to grasp. They think, this is horrible. Someone has to be held responsible, and somehow it has to be fixed. I have not yet heard from the Trump administration a persuasive counter-narrative to that one. And I wonder if, the kind of flailing around that this tariff threat making that went on last week and over the weekend was one attempt at that, but it's clearly not an effective one.
I mean, anyone who just, sort of drain this of ideology and partisanship, if it's at all possible, and you can see, as the Obama administration experienced in 2015, the intractable nature of this specific kind of problem, which is, if word goes out in Central America that America is open or is going to be somehow open, there is going to be this kind of flood. That's what happened as a result of Obama's extremely ill-advised, you know, embrace of the notion that illegal, you know, dreamers should get, you know, special constitutional protections or whatever, that somehow this was transmuted in 2015 into a message in Central America that America was liberalizing and that it was time to run across the border, right? So that's then, and, you know, that wasn't the intention, and they had this crisis, and all of this stuff happened in 2014 and 2015 with the cages and the families and 55,000 kids in a camp in McAllen, Texas, and all of that. And it was very bad for Obama politically and for the Democrats. And somewhat the same thing is happening with Trump in 2018, 2019. The question then is, since Trump is hostile rather than sympathetic to the families and all of that, is that better? I mean, not to be insanely, you know, cynical, but is that better politically?
Well, so he obviously thinks it is, right? But there's something, you know, it's true that when this happened under Obama, at least there was a kind of empathetic message of nobody wants this to happen. The message from Trump world is pretty consistently, if you don't want kids to die, don't bring them to the border. I mean, it's downright, it's heartless, really.
Well, Jeff Sessions literally said that, right? I mean, Jeff Sessions said that.
Yeah.
One of the last major acts of his attorney generalship was to push that line. Again, it's all a question of who's being appealed to, because at the same time, it seems to me that the Americans are killing kids at the border is a message that could really backfire on Democrats and people like, because these Border Patrol agents, the people who work in the Border Patrol and ICE and all of that, that's essentially accusing them of, you know, being, I don't know, the jailers of Abu Ghraib. I don't think people, if the more this becomes a focus of national attention, I don't think people mostly like or think that such a thing is fair to say, you know.
Well, no, they're members of the communities down there. They live there, and I think those, you know, occasionally you'll see a sort of in-depth reporting on these local border communities, and people will say, we really don't see the problem in the same way that it's often being discussed by the president, by the Democrats, or by the national media. So it's a much more complicated story, and I think that's a really good point about the Border Patrol agents.
The Journal editorial board had an interesting take, which
Wall Street Journal.
Interesting take, which is that by taking this upon himself to try to force Mexico into some sort of a situation where they would address the situation at the border by using trade as the weapon, they've done a lot of lasting damage both to the political economy and to Donald Trump's personal political standing in two different ways. One, now that you've introduced trade as a weapon to affect changes in political behavior of international actors, outside of the context of trade, you're reintroducing a system that we abandoned about 75 years ago. And it contradicts the GATT, contradicts WTO, NAFTA, to say everything. We're supposed to isolate trade disagreements within trade disputes and not let them expand, because we're not the only actor in the international system. Other actors will take their cue and now begin to behave in a very similar way, and it's literally devolution. The second is that by taking this upon himself, the president has shifted the focus away from congressional Democrats, which is where it should be. Congress is what should be addressing the humanitarian crisis at this border. The crisis is the result of the Flores decision, which says that we can't hold families in detention for beyond 72 hours. So you have to let the kids go. And unless we address that in legislation, this crisis is going to continue in perpetuity, because Mexico's not going to be able to stop the flow. They haven't even agree to any particular metrics. If there are metrics that they're supposed to adhere to, meaning that they have to demonstrate this reduced flow over this time period, we're not aware of them. Probably because they couldn't be agreed to, because there's no way to adhere to them. It would be to set themselves up for failure. So in that sense, the president has done himself political damage and done some damage to the international system as well.
I mean, I'm reminded of the fact that the president, you know, sat down with Pelosi and Schumer and said, I'm going to shut this government down unless you give me what I want on the border wall. And he shut the government down. He didn't get what he wanted on the border wall, and he had to sue for peace after 35 days, right?
The Democratic-led shutdown was also about immigration, too.
Right. So he...
And they lost that one.
He is focused on the idea that either, I mean, there are two ways. One of which is looking at it as a matter of a principle or, you know, something, or really, which is something really bad is happening. It's getting worse. I got to do something about this. The country has to do something about this, and we have to be tough, right? And the other is that he thinks that this is a great political issue for him. All the evidence that we have suggests that it isn't, and yet who are we to say that he doesn't know what's good for him politically? He's one of, you know, 44 people who's ever elected president, and so, you know, who are we?
Well, I mean, his base loves everything about this, right? Because he threatened Mexico, which in and of itself, you know, thrills them. Then the left freaked out, or everyone freaked out about it. That thrills them. So he trolled the domestic opposition, and then it turned out at least not to be the journal editorial accepted, at least not to be a horrific disaster as everyone freaked out, and Trump's, you know, the White House is going around calling it a victory. So, and you see articles like the one, you know, that Hugh Hewitt wrote. They do love everything about it.
But that love seems independent of actual, like, empirical observations of success, right?
Yeah.
Because they also would have loved the tariffs.
Right. That's true.
But he also got to play to his base by then denouncing, you know, his sick journalism. The New York Times story that pointed out that he hadn't done anything. So it really was sort of the perfect storm of Trump's base pandering.
I feel like these have limited shelf lives, too. I mean, the two manufactured crises and manufactured resolutions that I can remember is trade, generally. For the first 2 years, the on-again, off-again trade war with China, which was constantly resolved, and the markets would rally and collapse and what have you, and that was resolved by the president just simply not doing anything and declaring victory. And the other was the NFL, which was about like two news cycles worth of positive news for the president, forcing the NFL to back off support for the kneelers, right? But that didn't have any lasting impact.
Well, there's something of this dynamic in the North Korea stuff too. I mean, I think it's more serious,
well,
because it
flares and then it vanishes and then it flares and then it vanishes. So we can't really.
But then you do have people. You do have Trump fans going around the internet saying, "And he stopped. He's you know, put an end to the Korean War."
Yeah. I think the central thing here is, let's take the two polls. Okay, so one poll is open borders, we have no business doing anything, you know, we should be, you know, embracing these people, we should be accepting all undocumented, you know, aliens as citizens, and, you know, anything you do that slows any of this down is heartless and monstrous and genocidal and all of that. And then on the other hand, you have the I mean, its worst iteration, you know, shutting down the border, you know, kicking people out, all of that. I think these two poles, at their most extreme, are really noxious to most people. And then the question is, where does the center find itself? Or the other way of looking at it is, what's least unpopular? Will the Democratic view that the Trump administration has been heartless and mean horrible to these children and is mishandling this because of dark feelings about race and the place of white people and all of that, will that be more unpopular than Trump people saying, you know, don't bring your kids to the border if you don't want them to die? And I think that's the sort of 2020 thing here is whose view is going to be less unpopular? Not that anybody is going to actually hit the sweet spot and get it right, because there is no right. And this, you know, the problem of illegal immigration or immigration in the United States has been an issue pretty much since the early 1950s. So that's like 70 years now that the country has been grappling with the use of immigrant populaces to do work that Americans won't do at lower wages than Americans would agree to be paid, and do they get social services they don't deserve? Are they coming across and then committing crimes so that if they weren't, hadn't been allowed across, somebody wouldn't be dead now, and all of that? I mean, on and off, these have been issues that have been afflicting California politics mostly forever, and have now become national. And there's no solution to them. So Trump thinks, Trump has a visceral sense that this is the thing for him.
But he had that visceral sense in October of 2018, too.
I'm aware of that. That's what I'm saying. First of all, the October 2018 thing wasn't, of course, he was a proxy in that election, not the subject. But
he made himself the subject intentionally. Right. And his border policies. That's what he wanted to litigate, said very explicitly. He always reads the subjects. And the subtext is, I want this to be a referendum on me.
Now, but here's what's interesting about this. So ordinarily, you would say, well, the results of a midterm election cannot be used to predict the results of a general election because turnout is so much lower and, only activists come out and you don't know what first-time voters are going to do in a presidential election. But this election, this 2018 election, did not have that dynamic. There was a turnout of 118 million voters. That's like, it was almost 90% or something of a general election turnout. That's never happened before in American history. Remember Obama in 2014, after the election, where he lost the Senate, said it didn't count because only a third of registered voters turned out, and therefore, he didn't accept that somehow this was a national ideological turn against him. And though that was a sort of bizarrely weird thing to say, it had a little bit of merit, and you couldn't just completely dismiss it. But now, if 62 million people vote, or however many people, I can't remember, 118 million people voted in 2018. That is a kind of proxy for 2020. I mean, that, and so Noah's right that he used it. He used it, and it failed. It failed to move the needle in his direction. We don't know if it moved the needle against him, but we certainly can say that it didn't move the needle for him.
Remember the scenes of tear gas on the border that were promoted by the president's supporters and surrogates. It was that kind of toughness and fortitude in actually engagements, semi-military engagements on the border, was supposed to galvanize the president's vote, and it didn't work.
By the way, there's one other thing. Trump was at Pointe du Hoc on D-Day and made an elegiac speech that our contributor Matt Connetti said was great, was brilliant. A lot of people thought it was really an impressive speech. I read it. It's pretty good. I think it's maybe getting overpraised because it was so not what you would expect would come out of Trump's mouth. But even there, so there's a sense in which you can see there's some kind of, and maybe this will go on forever, a battle between the two sides, the sort of like the devil and angel on Trump's shoulders, The devil is, pick a fight with, which actress did he yell about? Bette Midler. Pick a fight with Bette Midler while you're meeting with the queen. And the other side, is use the pomp and power of the presidency to make a beautiful elegiac speech about one of the salvation moments of Western civilization, about which you don't necessarily have a lot of good to say.
The thing is that our media environment is so siloed that you can completely compartmentalize those two events.
Totally.
I don't think that either side of the equation is aware of one of those two things. One of them is 100% sure that there was a Bette Midler fight, never heard a minute of the speech.
Right. Well, the speech was given at, 7 o'clock in the morning, U.S. time. So they can maybe be forgiven for that. And, we still operate on the basis of the idea that, when Reagan delivered his speech on the 40th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, everybody in the world fainted dead away and died and never heard anything so great. Believe me, that was not true. It was a speech that gained in stature over the years, in part through the ministrations of its author, who did everything she could to make the world know that it was the greatest speech that had ever been written. And it's a really good speech. It's not that great a speech, actually, in my view, but it's a really good speech. And, great presidential speeches except on extremely rare occasions like Bush's on the 20th of September after September 11th, rarely, you know, sort of like galvanize an entire country, you know, because that's not, even if they're televised nationally. Having said that, the real question is there, are we going to see this fight, or is this just the nature of the Trump administration? Like, is he going to try to run the classic thing to do would be to try to run a positive campaign that said, I've done good for you. I've helped the country. The economy's better. Unemployment's lower. All of that. Give me another term so that those guys won't muck it up, and I'll try to stay the course and make sure that things don't fall apart. Right? That's what you do in a second term. Keep going. We've made a lot of. We've done a lot.
He could never. Right? I mean, he could start. He could begin with tallying up the positives, and then immediately go into. But it's a shame what they do, how they attack me.
Right. Yeah, why I've been personally right. wounded. Yes. Yeah, I mean, the answer to that question is, can Trump stay on script?
But the question is, who's writing the script? His script is not the script. His script, whatever script is written, there is no script.
Well, and the left is giving him plenty of material. I mean, someone wrote in the LA Times an op-ed calling detention centers concentration camps and arguing that we have to now use this term to describe these detention centers.
Yes, and she's an expert on concentration camps because she wrote a book on concentration camps, which leads me to believe I don't want to read her book on concentration camps. I mean, that was the best thing is like, she is the author of Concentration Camps, a History. You know, it's like, really? Fantastic. I'm sure this book is very measured, historically accurate. No, but I mean, there's all kinds of weirdness. You know, it's like if you go to the abortion debate, there's, again, individual articles that aren't, you know, no candidate is running on, but that piece that was published over the weekend that called abortion a moral killing or a necessary... who was peddling it? Saurabh Amari and Rod Dreher. We were like talking about it this weekend. This like really nightmarish piece about how, you know, abortion isn't only, you know, like necessary, but like it's a necessary murder because it proves, you know, that autonomy is important or something like that. I mean, stuff like that comes out during the, you know, like the general election cycle. Who knows what kind of effect it could have? And that's not anything that any campaign does, right? That's just the emanations of the culture at large, right. Which is probably one of the things that could really help Trump in inchoate terms. Like if I'll give you an example. I sent you guys this picture, right, from the stage of the Delacorte Theater, Shakespeare in the Park, the great New York City summer event where people can go wait online and see these often wonderful productions of Shakespeare for free. And so they're doing Much Ado About Nothing, and it's a classic, you know, new kind of staging of Shakespeare in unconventional settings. So the setting appears to be some kind of like apartment building in Atlanta, and on the building is a banner. And then there are people in kind of Elizabethan dress, African-Americans, sort of in the foreground. In the background, there's a giant banner that says, Stacey Abrams 2020. On the stage of Much Ado About Nothing in Shakespeare in the Park. Now, I don't think Shakespeare in the Park matters. It's not going to... I mean, even though there was a big fight over whether or not the Julius Caesar was Trump in a couple of years ago, remember? And then Lisa Loomer stormed the stage and everything. But I do think that the unhinged nature of the left in politicizing absolutely everything, and again, say it's September, October of 2020, and something really like out of... totally bananas comes out, you know, attacking Trump. That's the sort of thing could say, look, you know, they hate you, they hate me, they hate your values. They hate me, but don't even think about me. Like, they hate you. They think you're, you know, you're evil. And, you know, you want them to run everything? They already run Hollywood. You want them to run Washington also?
There's a fabulous psychological examination somewhere in there about how the left hasn't really embraced their losers from 2018 and sort of just kind of looked askance at the people who actually won, which is probably a dynamic that's really valuable for examining how the 2020 race is playing out so far.
That's an interesting point, and we will get to that after I tell you guys about Lending Club. With Lending Club, you can consolidate your debt or pay off credit cards with one fixed monthly payment. Since 2007, Lending Club has helped millions of people regain control of their finances with affordable fixed-rate personal loans. No trips to a bank, no high-interest credit cards. Just go to LendingClub.com, tell them about yourself and how much you want to borrow. Pick the terms that are right for you, and if you're approved, your loan is automatically deposited into your bank account in as little as a few days. Lending Club is the number one peer-to-peer lending platform with over $35 billion in loans issued. Go to LendingClub.com/commentary. Check your rate in minutes and borrow up to $40,000. That's LendingClub.com/commentary. LendingClub.com/commentary. All loans made by WebBank. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. So the Democrats embracing their losers or their safest winners possible, right? So the losers are people who were like Stacey Abrams, right? Who
Beto O'Rourke.
Right.
Now the winners who are really interesting people are people like Connor Lamb, who won a Trump district in Pennsylvania, Katie Hill, who won a Trump district in Southern California, Kyrsten Sinema, who is the first Democrat to represent Arizona in the Senate since 1988, who's an actual kind of a blue dog, which is obvious, and has the biographic and the demographic features because she's like very bisexual and what have you. I mean, the kind of thing that you would think would get the glossy treatment, but doesn't.
Right, because who's taking up all the atmosphere?
Well, isn't this a continuation in part of they need to embrace the losers because it continues the narrative that democracy itself has been in peril since 2016, right? We have to abolish the Electoral College. We have to pack the courts. We have to embrace these losers who were, as certainly in the Stacey Abrams case, the narrative continues to be she was cheated out of her rightful, you know, win because there was supposedly voter suppression. Say
there's absolutely no evidence to support that. It's a complete conspiracy.
Right, exactly.
The reason, I mean, it seems to me the Occam's razor here is that the national media environment is left of center, far left of center. They like the progressive movement more than they like the centrist movement. All the people who have won these Trump districts are purple representatives. They're kind of blue dogish, and they're trying to advance the notion that this is a farther left party than it has been historically. And so in order to do that, you need to embrace the progressives, even if they lose, especially if they lose, because then they're martyrs.
See, this is where things get crazy, because they're not blue dogs. Most of them are, you know, if they had run in 2008, they would have been on they would have been maybe not on the far left of the party, but they would have been based securely in the near left to left of the party issue wise. It is only in relation to people like Rashida Tlaib and, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that they appear to be moderate. And this is the great question to me about 2020, as we were going to talk about now, in relation to this latest Des Moines Register poll of Iowa, that Biden has slipped a bit, not as much as the headlines would have you believe, sort of like 5 points down in a poll with, I think, a 4-point margin of error, but he's still 10 points ahead of Bernie Sanders. Elizabeth Warren is gaining on Sanders. Sanders has slipped 6 or 7 points, which is a larger slip than Biden, since he was much lower, had much fewer points to drop. And Pete Buttigieg has surged and is now in double digits. So it's a four-person race in Iowa right now, right? Biden, Sanders, Warren, and Buttigieg, and everybody else is gornished. And of course, my favorite is that Bill de Blasio, literally not a single person in the poll said that he or she supported Bill de Blasio for president. Not a one respondent. Okay.
And as I saw someone say, that still strikes them as too high.
That's right. So, not to, you know,
it's
not
a Siena poll of New York that showed Trump had about 10 points more favorability.
Yeah.
Than
I mean, not to kick a guy when he's high, but you know, I just wanted to, you know, bring that up. So the thing is that Biden, so the great effort now, since everything seemed to be the only story that you could tell about the Democratic Party since March, is that Biden appeared to be solidifying his, cementing his status as a front runner who was going to have a very hard time someone to catch him unless something catastrophic happened to his candidacy, now the effort is being made to say that Biden, you know, may be in trouble. Now, first of all, it's one state. It is the first state. It is not a natural Biden state, I don't think. But nonetheless, he is still winning by 10 points. So, or something like that. Or
if there's an early state you would expect him to lose as the establishmentarian candidate, it would be Iowa.
Right. Well, in theory, he should not be able to win New Hampshire either because Sanders is next door in Vermont, the blah, blah, blah. But he's like 30 point last poll of New Hampshire. He was up like 275,000 points. So I don't know what that means. But yeah, Iowa is the caucus goers in Iowa are famously far more liberal than a party in general. All of that. Who knows if that's even true anymore, given the way the parties have polarized. But nonetheless, so this is important because the Biden narrative is I think very much tied into what you guys were talking about, which is crazy, not crazy. Biden implicitly says, look, let's face it. You may like them. You may like their opinions. You may like how tough they are. Everyone that I'm running against is crazy. They're crazy. And I am not crazy. I'm old. I've been around a long time. I was Barack Obama's right hand. I'm a white guy who can talk to white guys. I'm a lunch pail guy who can talk to lunch pail guys. That's how I ran my candidacies for the Senate in Delaware. And you want these socialist lunatic? I mean, who's going to vote for these people out in the places where we know where we're going to win? We're going to win all these other places. There are these like 3-4 places we need to win, and these crazy people aren't going to win. So you got to vote for me. It seems to me that is the meta message, right? And the poll and the media now seem to want to push the idea that he's fading and that somehow, you know, Elizabeth Warren, who is issuing a lot of policy proposals, is surging. Though it appears that Warren surging means that she just takes a bite out of Sanders, not out of Biden. So is this enough? The crazy, not crazy message. Abe does not believe that this is enough.
I think the problem for him is that, and we'll see it more and more, and we began to see it with his flip-flop on his support for the Hyde Amendment. He's the only candidate, because he is the not crazy candidate, who ironically faces an obstacle course throughout the campaign. Every other candidate, we know they're crazy or not, you know their spiel. This is what they say. This is where they stand. They're on the leftist, far left of every possible issue. He's going to have to at every turn say, okay, well, I may seem a little behind the times in this, but I was right. Or, you know, now that I think about it, I'm not. And I think as that sort of he's going to have to face that decision every step of the way. That's going to do some damage to him. I'm not saying he's collapsing or fading, but I think that is his unique challenge.
Well, everybody else is arguing, making a case that we've heard for the last 30 years, which is essentially bold colors, not pale pastels, right? Every one of them is saying we got to go big because right. No one's going to get excited about this, you know, establishmentarian centrist message. And 9 times out of 10, the establishmentarian centrist message wins.
Right. Well, so there are two ways of looking at 2016, right? Which is that Hillary actually won and that Trump pulled this crazy inside straight with these 80,000 voters in 3 states. And so this notion that you won't need to entirely upend the party and go to the left and go crazy is nuts. All you need to do is win the right people in the right places and you overturn the result. And you win not only not a national majority, but you'll win the Electoral College by 20 or 30, you know, electors. That's one. And the other is that Trump pulled off a world historical change election in which the white working class has now expressed its, you know, the whole Trump narrative. And, you know, Democrats seem themselves to bounce hourly between one and the other, right? That he didn't really win, he's not legitimate, or he has broken our politics wide open, and that if we don't assert our most visceral political views. He's just going to eat our lunch and, you know, the country, the democracy is going to be finished forever.
The alternative, I mean, the Republican version of that is Barack Obama. The Barack Obama 2008 was the radical candidate, and that he hadn't done any of the groundwork necessary to appease party leaders and make himself a palatable alternative to Hillary Clinton, which is just revisionist history.
Right, but I mean, that's ridiculous. Obama won 70 million votes and 375 electoral, I mean, won, you know, he won the largest number of votes in American history in a 375
in the primary process.
Oh, yeah. But all those complaints are right. So I agree that, in fact, with the exception of Trump, I would say, as the Trump is really the only insurgent candidate to win a primary season ever. I mean, maybe McGovern, but that was a weird that was a weird year. Or, you know, you could say Jimmy Carter, although Jimmy Carter wasn't exactly an insurgent, he was just running.
McGovern 72 or McGovern 68?
No, McGovern 72.
Because McGovern 68 definitely won.
but I mean, you know, Trump is the only, this notion that what you do is you appeal to the most extreme elements of your party's base and then win is belied by, you know, I don't know, it's like one of those things where it's a question of how many data points do you use? It's like, use hundreds of them and there's one outlier, and you still should probably treat it like an outlier, particularly since the win wasn't that decisive. But Christine, we've been mansplaining here for too long.
Well, I was actually thinking of Biden and his chances as being a little bit more. I'm a little more bullish on him. I mean, I think that he's going to be aided a lot more than we might realize by the media narrative that focuses on this, you know, pro-progressive, we need an insurgent, you know, and certainly among the, I mean, I would say that a lot of people would argue that Bernie Sanders might have been a successful insurgent primary candidate if you know, Hillary hadn't rigged the system against him, which still angers a lot of Democratic primary voters. But I think with Warren, I mean, you see this, it's like the make fetch happen comment from Mean Girls. Like, she's trying to make policy happen. So like every other day, I mean, we joke about this now. We were joking about it before we taped the podcast about there's a new policy every day, all of which will be paid for by, you know, the couple of pennies tax on the rich and et cetera, et cetera. But those proposals, because there's far too many of them and she won't focus on a single one, and because it's couched in this rhetoric of class warfare, which I think her progressive base adores, but which the Democratic voters that Biden is targeting don't necessarily find persuasive, he's happy to let her and some of these other candidates continue with that message. It's why he wasn't in Iowa, and they are all claiming they're not going to put a target on his back and attack him directly because, oh, they're Democrats, they're better than that. But that's going to crumble in the next few weeks too. And they're, you know, his flip-flop notwithstanding, I'm not sure he is going to have to constantly be responding. I think he will just either ignore some of those debates and just continue on his the trajectory he's already gone in terms of his strategy, or he's if he does respond, it's going to be the way he did to the groping message, right? It's like, I'll give you a little bit, but then when I'm back on the trail, I'll be joking about it within a few weeks and nobody's going to care.
Look, I'm going to defend hotly defend the flip-flop as a political matter. I mean, I said on the podcast on Thursday that he would do it and do it soon. I didn't know it was going to be like 6 hours after we taped. but I figured, you know, the point is, if you're going to do it and you know you're probably going to have to do it, you might as well do it immediately, stanch the bleeding, come up with a face-saving line, which I think I predicted, which is that given the threats posed by this, you know, unprecedented assault on abortion rights, all past bets are off, right? We really have to stand firm on blah, 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 blah. So he did that. He did it the minute that it was clear that he was going to have to do it. And then afterwards, I noticed this interesting blend that mostly I'm sorry to say, using my own Facebook page as a way of gauging this, but I do have 5,000 Facebook friends of different ideological persuasions, so there may be something to it that both left and right on my page, people were saying, this is it, he's done. So conservatives who are not primary voters and don't know anything about the Democratic Party, really. Or they're like, well, you see, this is it. I mean, this is people really, they don't like abortion and they, you know, they don't want federal funding for abortion. That's really bad and it's going to hurt them in the general and it maybe even hurt them in the primary because there's a lot of silent, okay, there's that. And then left-wingers are saying, you know, this just proves he's got no principles, he doesn't hold to principle and all that. This is a total misreading on both ends. First of all, the whole point here is that Biden looked and saw that the consensus view in his party was for the repeal of the Hyde Amendment forbidding federal funding of abortion. And if you go toward the consensus in your party, you are moving toward the center. I know that sounds weird because it seems like an extreme policy for a lot of people, but in fact, it's not. You want to hit the center. You want to hit the consensus view of the party, or you want to stand outside it because you want to make some point about your independence and your how you are heterodox. There are things about which you are willing to be heterodox. But Biden is already heterodox in the Democratic understanding because he's an old white guy. So that's his heterodoxy. I'm not sure on views he's supposed to be all that heterodox. And the notion that people 6 months from now are going to go back and say, you know, he used to support the Hyde Amendment, and then he cravenly moved toward my position. And therefore, he's contemptible, and I'm not going to vote for him, bananas. And we have enormous amounts of political history to show that often, as I said the other time, often among, particularly among activists, people actually like conversions. They like the candidate that moves toward them because it proves that their position is powerful.
That's great for the primary, but this is still a minority proposition. We don't have a ton of recent polling, but we have the 2016 Harvard poll. It shows that it's really unpopular to use Medicaid funding to fund abortions. And it's unpopular across the board. And it's incredibly unpopular among people who are making less than $25,000 a year. Really poor working class Americans really, really don't like the idea of using federal funds, taxpayer dollars, to fund abortion. So great in the primary because it's a Democratic support. Democrats support it. Wealthy Democrats really support it. But everybody else doesn't.
Okay, but it's not going to be a primary issue in the general election campaign. You know why?
But Trump will make it an issue.
You know why Trump won't make it that much of an issue? Because people don't like talking about abortion. People blame candidates when they go too hard on abortion in general elections. You will note that if you can avoid it, if you can avoid talking about it, both pro and con, you avoid it. Mitt Romney avoided it. Trump avoided it. Hillary avoided it, Obama avoided it, Bush avoided it, Gore avoided it, Clinton avoided it. It's not an issue that voters want to hear about.
I don't think it's going to move the needle, but I guarantee you Trump will make an issue out of it.
He will, and he would. But if he does, he's making a mistake because it makes people uncomfortable. And then they don't like being, they blame the person who is making them uncomfortable for talking about it.
Because he doesn't know any of that, because he doesn't actually have strong opinions on abortion. He acts like he does.
I think he probably has pretty strong personal opinions on abortion. I'm not going to go much further than that. But
well, and I also think that that's true up to a point. But I also think that as this change of opinion on the Hyde Amendment that Biden just demonstrated shows, the activist groups are actually in some ways becoming louder. And the whole Shout Your Abortion campaign and the extreme pressure and swift and, you know, Twitter mob pressure that's put on people and candidates about this issue, I think that might come into play in a general election. And, you know, especially if you have if Biden gets the nomination and you have what's considered a kind of, once again, a traditional Democrat and the progressives feel left out of the conversation, that might be how they express their discontent. That redounds to Trump's benefit, obviously, but I wouldn't underestimate the activist groups on that issue now, certainly on the progressive end of it, because it's a lot more swift and brutal
and
than
the
it
right.
used to be.
One of Donald Trump's key ways in which he keeps the coalition together is to demonstrate his bona fides on judges. And what is the issue?
Right.
The singular most important issue for people who vote on courts. I mean, it's not it's not just constitutional issues. It's really about religious freedom, and abortion is at the heart of that. So I think it just it helps him keep his coalition together, too.
Okay. He talks about courts. He doesn't talk about abortion. You talk about courts as a proxy for abortion, so you don't have to talk about abortion.
But
you're making my point
for
me.
He
doesn't say the subtext in this case at all.
But but look at the way that the pro-abortion message has changed just in a few years. Now, abortion is health care. Health care is a very important issue to Americans, and there's a way in which there's a kind of rhetorical shift going on. And I don't know. I think it is. I think it's possible that in this election we might see it become an issue in a way that I agree with you, John. In the past, it's
he
goes
avoided
on
the
both
stump
sides.
And does the Ralph Northam monologue verbatim.
Yeah, but that's about infanticide. What Northam did was tilt into infanticide. That's like a 90% issue. It's not even a 70% issue. I'm only pointing this out that, you know, my entire life I've been hearing from pro-life friends of mine that abortion is the most important electoral issue in the world. And I believe it is a key proxy issue. It is a way that candidates express their social views in a proxy way. It is almost never discussed in a general election.
Yeah, I agree, actually. And also, recall how clumsily Trump, when he did talk about abortion, how clumsily he did so, talking about, yes, I believe there should be some punishment.
That's one of the reasons why I think he's going to be so comfortable with it, because he doesn't understand the contours of the issue.
Anyway, the whole question now is Biden going to suffer? You're saying if Biden wins, he'll suffer in the general, right? Okay, so that may or may not be true. The question is, will he suffer in the primary season for having flip-flopped on the Hyde Amendment? That seems insane to me. However, I also find it implausible if he becomes the nominee. And if he becomes the nominee, we'll know early. If he's not, then we'll know by Super Tuesday that he's the nominee. If he's not the nominee, we'll have no idea who the president's going to be or who the Democratic candidate's going to be. The idea that the party has to unify behind him and every vote wrung from the United States of America for Biden will be the paramount idea, not only among liberals but among the left, because there is no choice. There is no binary choice for them. They cannot vote for Trump. They hate Trump. Trump is destroying the country. Trump is destroying democracy. Trump is evil. Trump is everything bad. And so the idea will be, keep your mouth shut. You know, this happens every time. Activists always complain about this. They come to us and say, keep your mouth shut because we have to unify. But in this case, the unification message is, I don't know that if people start going off the reservation, other Democrats and liberals will kill them. I mean, not kill them. They might kill them literally, but I mean, this will be every word that is spoken that is negative to Biden is like giving a vote to Trump. That will be that will be said. You want to talk about subtext that will be spoken? That will be spoken. People will say that on MSNBC and CNN. They will say it on Twitter.
They already are. I mean, there's people who the activist wing that says, yeah, if it's Biden, I'm going to stay home because there's no point in voting. It's just, you know, changing the guard. And they get harassed for it. I'm not sure how much social pressure it's going to be. It's going to be really, it's going to be effective enough to shut them up, but I'm not sure whether or not it'll get people out to vote.
Well, that's a different issue. Whether it gets people, getting people out to vote is a secondary, is a almost technical matter, you know? And remember, he's not going to be running against somebody who should have been indicted but wasn't, or, you know, who we were told in the middle of the summer that she was running should have been indicted, but James Comey wasn't going to indict her because I don't even know why. You know, Trump is not, there is going to be an accelerant Trump's not going to have the accelerant that he had in 2016 that Hillary provided. He'll have his own accelerants if the economy stays strong and all that, but that he will not, Biden will not provide that to him. And one interesting piece of warning, people seem to be putting a lot of faith in the idea that a major issue can be made out of Biden's son, Hunter, and some business that he had in
Ukraine.
Ukraine. Republicans who try to make an issue out of Biden's family connections are making would be making the most catastrophic mistake.
Pot kettle.
Not just that. I mean, you know, this is a man who 3 years ago sat by his son's bedside as he died from cancer, you know, 40 years after his wife and other children were killed in a car accident. I mean, and had to he had to maintain a bedside vigil beside a kid of his who was recovering from that accident. You don't messing with Biden's family is a is maybe the dumbest political move that a Republican or Trump or anybody could possibly make, because if Biden then turns toward the camera and says, "I have one son, I had two sons, I now have one, and I sitting here listening to my surviving son being trashed for political purposes by this man." You know, or by these people, you know. I mean, just give the guy an opening. Go ahead, give him an opening to talk about his, you know. Anyway, that's what I'm saying. I see it happening. I see it. One of the uses of Facebook is that you can see what people are starting to bubble up over. You know, that would just be doing Biden a huge favor. So I guess with that, we will bring this to a close. For Abe, Noah, and Christine, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.